Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. We have all the trees we need. Trump wants to revive the lumber industry. The president is calling for increased logging in national forests and raising trade protections against Canadian exports. By Ryan Dezember. Skakomaw County, Washington. This slice of southern Washington is home to some of the most lush and productive timberland in the world, carpeted by Douglas fir and hemlock from the slopes of Mount St. Helens to the Columbia River Gorge. The local lumber industry has shriveled nonetheless. Sawmills have been closing across the Pacific Northwest over the past 30 years. There is just one left in Skamania County, down from six during its logging heyday. Limited log supply from the region's national forest has cut off their raw material, while cheap lumber from Canada has taken market share for their finished product. Owners of the remaining mills have high hopes that President Trump will deliver relief by increasing logging in national forests and raising trade protections against Canadian exports. Although the latter can be achieved with a stroke of the president's pen, meaningfully boosting the federal timber harvest could take years and be impeded by litigation and red tape. "We have all the trees we need," Trump said early in his term while threatening broad tariffs on Canadian trade. Regional Forest Service supervisors have been directed to map five-year plans to contribute to a 25% increase in the overall volume of timber harvested from national forests to satisfy Trump's call for greater wood production. Last month, the Agriculture Department began the process of rescinding its roadless rule, which prohibits road building or reconstruction on roughly 59 million federal acres. This is just one barrier to logging. Others protect rivers, old-growth forests, habitat for northern spotted owls, and marbled murrelets. Trump's push to build up domestic production capacity of raw materials has the White House considering tariff on lumber imports in the name of national security, as it has with steel and copper. Any import taxes Trump imposes would fall on top of the duties that are already collected on lumber that is imported from Canada. The anti-dumping and countervailing duties on Canadian softwood lumber stem from a trade dispute that has been raging for decades. The combined duty rate on Canadian lumber is expected to more than double in the coming weeks to about 34% for most producers, regardless of Trump's tariff decision. "This administration is very supportive of our industry," said Devin Stockfish, chief executive of Seattle's Weyerhaeuser, which is the country's largest private landowner and most prolific lumber producer. "If you go back in time, you very rarely heard a president talk about lumber and timber as much as President Trump. Two earlier presidents set the Pacific Northwest lumber industry on its course. Theodore Roosevelt created the U.S. Forest Service in 1905 amid concern that lumber barons like Frederick Weyerhaeuser would strip the Pacific Northwest, as they had the Lake States, and exhaust the country's timber supply unless the government stepped in. Temperate rainforests along the Pacific Ocean and the Cascade Range were set aside as public reserves. Overlogging again became a worry in the late 1980s. The concern was dwindling old growth, however, not running out of lumber. To turn back the chainsaws, environmentalists took what was then a novel approach and used the Endangered Species Act to sue on behalf of the threatened northern spotted owl. President Bill Clinton stepped in to break the stalemate. The result was the 1994's Northwest Forest Plan, which reduced logging on federal lands. In practice, there has been even less logging than the plan prescribed. "It was an overcorrection," said Garrett Stump, a third-generation lumberman who is vice president of log procurement at WKO, which operates the last sawmill in Skamania County. "It's been a slow bleed since then." The sting comes not just from job losses at the hundreds of Northwestern sawmills that have closed. Roughly 80% of Skamania County is federal forest land, and a further 10% or so is controlled by the state. That means that the county earns tax revenue on most of its territory from timber receipts, which have slowed to a drip. recent budget cuts forced the local school district to lay off teachers and close two of its four schools. The WKO sawmill in Carson once sourced about 70% of its logs from federal land, but that share has declined to less than 15%. The mill buys logs from industrial timberland operations, as well as state and county forests and even locals clearing off a couple of acres, Stump said. A computer scans each log that enters the mill and instantly determines how many boards it will yield, then tells a machine how to position it through the first set of bandsaws to achieve the optimal breakdown. Everything we do in our mill is to make it more efficient, more competitive, so that we can pay more for logs when we need to, Stump said. He said a 25% boost in the federal timber harvest sounds substantial, but if the recent output of the nearby Gifford-Pinochet National Forest were to increase at that rate, the extra wood would sustain a shift at the mill for about a month. Trump's order wouldn't denude the national forest, nor is it likely to have much impact on the price Americans pay for lumber. A 25% increase from recent levels would add less than 1% to the total U.S. timber harvest, according to Campbell Global, J.P. Morgan's Timberland Investing Unit. Still in pockets of the Northwest, any additional logs will help. Over the past 18 months, 7 sawmills in Oregon have announced closures. The number one reason is that they don't have enough logs, not that we have a low lumber timber price, said Levi Bielart, owner of B&G Logging. B&G won bidding to thin about 600 acres of Douglas fir that was planted more than 50 years ago on the Surfside slopes of the Siuslaw National Forest. The Forest Service wanted about 40% of the canopy cover cleared to make room for other species and restore the monoculture to a mixed forest. The wood, about 13 million board feet, will go to B&G Sawmill in Philomath and others nearby. The other problem for the Northwest mills is across the border. Canada's lumber producers built up more capacity than needed to supply their own market, and they ship wood to the U.S. to keep mills running. U.S. sawyers have argued successfully in trade cases that their Canadian competitors are supplied with subsidized government logs and that they offer 2x4s over the border for less than they sell them at home. The resulting countervailing and anti-dumping duties are calculated annually using sales data from 2 years prior and collected from Canadian exporters at the border. Canadian interests and U.S. home builders say the duties added to the cost of American housing. Although they disagree about the extent, U.S. producers don't deny that the duties lift lumber prices. They say they are necessary to level competition. Last year, about 24% of the softwood lumber consumed in the U.S. was Canadian. That is down from roughly 35% in the 1990s and a sign that the duties are working, proponents say. Big Canadian lumber producers have closed facilities at home and invested in sawmills in the U.S. South, where there is plenty of pine on private plantations. Stimson Lumber Chairman Andrew Miller, a seventh-generation lumberman, said Canadian mills are now quicker to curtail output when lumber demand drops. We don't spend very long in that negative cash flow zone, which is reassuring, said Miller, who is also chairman of the U.S. Lumber Coalition, which has fought for the duties. Stimson, which owns about 600,000 acres of timberland and 6 Northwest sawmills, is building a new mill to replace its existing facility outside Portland. Upgrades to other mills in Oregon and Idaho could be next if Trump imposes a lasting tariff, Miller said. We have capacity we could grow into with the right market conditions, he said. Policy. Bipartisan pairs say they will force House vote on releasing Epstein files after recess. Reps Messi and Khanna say they have enough votes to pass a measure seeking more information about Jeffrey Epstein. By Natalie Andrews. A bipartisan pair of congressmen pushing for the release of files related to Jeffrey Epstein say they will continue to press the issue when Congress returns from an extended summer break, keeping attention on a political landmine for top House Republicans. Reps Thomas Massey, R. Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, D. California, are readying a petition to force a floor vote on legislation that would give Attorney General Pam Bondi 30 days to release files related to Epstein and his associate Ghislaine Maxwell. It would force a full release of the files, Massey said on ABC's This Week on Sunday. It's not a pretty please, would you release the files? It's the force of law. Under House rules, if the petition is signed by the majority of lawmakers, it forces a vote. Massey and 11 Republicans say they are ready to join Democrats on the petition. House Speaker Mike Johnson, R. Louisiana, recently adjourned the House until September and said he wanted to give the Trump administration space to handle the issue. Trump continues to face questions about his previous relationship with Epstein, who died in prison in 2019 while awaiting trial on federal charges of sex trafficking. The Wall Street Journal published an article earlier this month about a letter bearing Trump's name that was included in a 2003 birthday album for Epstein. Trump has called the letter non-existent and sued the journal's reporter, journal publisher Dow Jones, parent company News Corp, and executives, alleging the article defamed him. A Dow Jones spokeswoman said, "We have full confidence in the rigor and accuracy of our reporting and will vigorously defend against any lawsuit." A News Corp spokesman didn't respond to a request for comment. Trump has said his relationship with Epstein ended before the disgraced financier pleaded guilty to procuring a minor for prostitution in 2008. When Epstein was arrested again in 2019, Trump said he hadn't talked to him in 15 years. Trump and top administration officials promised to release the so-called Epstein files and have faced mounting criticism from their own supporters for not releasing more information. In response to the backlash, the Justice Department has since asked courts to release grand jury transcripts from the Epstein and Maxwell investigations. The Wall Street Journal reported last week that President Trump is mentioned in the files along with others. Being mentioned in the files isn't evidence of wrongdoing. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche traveled last week to meet Maxwell, the imprisoned longtime confidant of Epstein, in Tallahassee, Florida, where she is serving a 20-year sentence after her 2021 conviction on sex trafficking and other offenses for facilitating Epstein's sexual abuse of underage teens. The House Oversight Committee has also issued a subpoena to require Maxwell to testify. Prosecutors said Maxwell selected young, vulnerable victims for Epstein and at times participated in the abuse herself. She has appealed her conviction to the U.S. Supreme Court. At her sentencing in 2022, she called Epstein her one-time boyfriend, a manipulative, cunning, and controlling man who fooled all those in his orbit. Questions about the late convicted sex predator have exploded inside the GOP since the Justice Department announced earlier this month it had concluded that there was no foul play involved in his 2019 death and there is no client list of powerful accomplices to be released. A vote could put Republicans in an uncomfortable position of having to decide whether to support having the files released and defying President Trump or risk alienating voters who want more transparency. Massey said Sunday the issue could cost Republicans their House majority. Johnson last week accused Massey, who has clashed with Trump and Johnson on other legislation, of trying to inflict political pain. Is the pain he's talking about that somebody in our party will be embarrassed by those files? Then that's not a good excuse, Massey said on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. Is the pain he's talking about is that the legislators, when they vote, have to pick between protecting the embarrassment of the rich and powerful versus getting justice for the victims. Johnson, on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, called the Massey and Khanna effort reckless in the way that it is drafted and presented, saying it doesn't protect victims. The two lawmakers countered, saying their bill would redact victims' names and hide any child pornography, which is one reason the Justice Department has cited for not releasing the files. Policy. GOP senator fights White House over billions in frozen funds. Maine's Susan Collins says Trump administration is pushing the limits of its constitutional powers in clawing back money approved by Congress, by Siobhan Hughes and Ken Thomas. Republican Susan Collins has spent much of her almost three-decade Senate career mastering the appropriations process, putting in late hours to secure the funding that sustains the military, keeps the government humming, and helps when disasters strike. Her workhorse style has benefited Maine. The centrist has steered billions to her state for infrastructure and other projects from her perch on the Senate Appropriations Committee and rose to become its chair this year. But instead of settling into a job that traditionally shaped the contours of America's budget, Collins is immersed in a full-blown public battle, one that pits her against her own party's White House and the cost-slashing officials who occupy its budget office. The Senate's top appropriator has run squarely into Office of Management and Budget Director Russ Voigt. She pushes the executive branch to spend money that Congress appropriated. The budget chief pushes back. Often the money doesn't get spent. The White House's budget office is really pushing the limit of what the executive branch can do without the consent of the legislative branch, Collins said in an interview. The administration has taken tight control of government spending and has encroached deeply upon the legislative branch's turf. Collins's predicament offers a window into that fight as she wins some battles, but not the broader war. She and her colleagues are being overridden by the White House, a dynamic that would have been hard to imagine in prior administrations of either party. Voigt declined to comment. His office referred to previous remarks on the administration's views on spending authority and its work to win approval this month for a $9 billion package to claw back spending through what is called rescissions, a process that cuts money previously approved by Congress. This is the kind of thing that's necessary for us to change the paradigm of the way the town has worked, Voigt said this month at a Christian Science Monitor breakfast. More broadly, we have the ability and the executive tools to fund less than what Congress appropriated, Voigt said on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. Voigt, before joining government, was co-author of the Project 2025 Blueprint for Downsizing the Government. Many Republicans are on board with the White House efforts, but some have joined Collins in raising concerns about the cuts and questioning whether the executive branch is overstepping. During the fight over rescissions, Collins brought her research materials to the Senate floor, to a closed-door lunch, and to a hearing. Her Republican colleagues paid attention. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican Mississippi, warned that the dearth of specificity flagged by Collins was approaching a disregard for the constitutional responsibilities of the legislative branch. Without more details, lawmakers couldn't be sure which programs would be cut. She's got a point, and it's a very strong point, Wicker said. But like all but two Republicans, Collins and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, he voted yes on the rescissions anyway, saying the $9 billion in reductions to foreign aid and public broadcasting was an important step to control deficits. The administration is promising more rescissions and signaling it will claw back more funds with or without Congress's help. Voigt has denied that he is crossing any lines. Everything we do is legal, he told reporters in February. Voigt has testified to Congress that the Impoundment Control Act, which allows the White House to pause spending only in limited circumstances, violates the Constitution. The investigative arm of Congress has found that in some instances, the White House's action violated the law. The White House denies breaking any laws. The standoff is approaching a pivot point. Funds that expire in September have been held up, often without the required notification to Congress. Funds for the National Institutes of Health, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and foreign aid are among those at risk. If the OMB keeps those funds on hold, they are vulnerable to being sent back to the U.S. Treasury, either through a congressional vote or through an untested approach Voigt has dubbed a pocket rescission, in which the White House bypasses Congress by making a rescission request right before the end of the fiscal year. Many lawmakers, including Collins, view pocket rescissions as illegal. Voigt has defended their legality while saying the OMB hasn't decided whether to use that tool. Billions unspent. Collins's effort to get the budget office to release money and the ways Voigt has sought to curb spending are a microcosm of the broader fight. 1 week after Trump was sworn in and before Voigt was confirmed, the OMB froze potentially trillions of dollars in federal funds, but quickly canceled the move after public outcry. Collins said the administration had the right to review federal programs, but called the move overreach. Vote quickly reasserted himself. In March, the OMB refused to follow a requirement to spend all of the $12.4 billion in money designated as emergency funds. The law explicitly said that the White House had to spend all or none. It is incumbent on all of us to follow the law as written, not as we would like it to be, Collins wrote in a letter with her Democratic committee counterpart. The White House argued that the president had to agree that each expenditure counted as an emergency and that some foreign aid didn't meet the standard. The funds remain frozen. That same month, Vought stopped publishing data on a website showing the pace at which money was being allotted to various agencies consistent with annual spending laws. He said that it would require the disclosure of sensitive information, forcing the Trump administration to reveal how it made decisions. Collins complained, as the move made it difficult to see which funds were being held up. A federal judge this past week found that the OMB violated the law. Collins joined other Republicans in successfully pressing Vought to release about $7 billion that public schools use for such purposes as after-school programs, teacher training, adult literacy, and English language learning. The fight is spilling over into the annual spending process in Congress, where Republicans, who narrowly control both chambers, need Democrats' support to reach a deal to fund the operations of the government for next year. Some lawmakers are worried that additional rescissions requests that are being considered by the White House might prompt Democrats to accuse the GOP of tanking talks and threaten a shutdown. A spending deal requires 60 Senate votes, while rescissions only need 51. Republicans are making it much harder to reach a deal before the fall deadline, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, said. Collins doesn't want another rescissions package. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, said any resolution of the broader fight between the branches will end up in courts. Senator Rand Paul, Republican, Kentucky, a spending hawk, said he believes the Supreme Court will ultimately decide the matter. Through it all, Collins has sought to protect her state. She successfully fought to reverse the cancellation of a grant relied on by Maine's lobster industry, a months-long process that included calls to the White House Chief of Staff, Susie Wiles, and Vice President J.D. Vance. She teamed up with other senators to lobby the administration successfully to release more than $400 million in low-income heating assistance funds. She got the Education Department to release nearly $5 million for Maine colleges. When the administration holds up specific funding or grants, she said, that is very frustrating, but my response is to go right to work. Most recently, she had a high-profile success when she led a charge to preserve $400 million in funding for the PEPFAR Global AIDS Treatment Program. The fight is far from over. A week after Congress forced the Trump administration to release the PEPFAR money sought by Collins, the spigot hasn't fully opened, lawmakers said. It undermines her credibility, said Senator Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina, a Collins supporter. Tillis said Congress could tie up future rescissions package if the White House didn't live up to its PEPFAR commitment. If they betray our promise, then they shouldn't expect any confidence going forward, Tillis said. Vought said Trump isn't opposed to PEPFAR and has supported its life-saving treatments, but he doesn't want to support groups in the program that don't share the values of the administration. The Congressional Government Accountability Office has the power to file a lawsuit to force the release of the money. It has only ever done so once before in the 1970s. The GAO has opened about 50 investigations into the Trump administration's funding freezes and told lawmakers that the OMB hasn't been responsive. This past week, it found that the Trump administration had illegally withheld money for Head Start, the early childhood education program. Mark Paoletta, OMB general counsel, wrote in a May letter that the GAO requests are voluminous, burdensome, and inappropriately invasive. he said the OMB would cooperate with the GAO in a manner that ensures that the burdens of such engagements don't unduly impede OMB's ability to implement the president's agenda and comply with OMB's other legal duties. Middle East, Israel said it is pausing fighting in parts of Gaza to allow aid in. A deadly hunger crisis is spreading across the enclave, by Feliz Solomon. Israel announced a tactical pause in military activity in parts of the Gaza Strip and the establishment of safe routes for humanitarian aid as a deadly hunger crisis spreads across the enclave. Israel's military said on Sunday that it would suspend its activity from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day until further notice in accordance with government directives. Secure routes for the passage of aid will be permanently established, open from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., it added. The announcement follows growing pressure from Arab and Western officials over what residents and humanitarian workers say is the worst hunger crisis to grip the enclave since the Hamas-led attack on Israel in October 2023 sparked the war in Gaza. Israel blocked the flow of aid into Gaza in March before allowing it to resume in May, backing a new program that has distributed supplies at much lower levels. President Trump on Sunday said images of Palestinians starving in Gaza were terrible. He said the U.S. would do more to help Gaza, but that he wanted other countries to step in too. If we weren't there, I think people would have starved, frankly, he said. He also said he spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this weekend and said he thought the leader was doing a good job. Israel and the United Nations have accused each other of impeding aid. Israel's military invited journalists to one of two border crossings through which aid can enter Gaza, Kerem Shalom, on Sunday, to view what it said were hundreds of truckloads abandoned by the UN and other aid agencies. Pallets of dried food goods such as flour, beans, canned tomatoes, and baby formula sat uncovered in the searing summer heat. Some boxes and bags had burst, with goods spilling onto the ground and being pecked at by birds. The containers were marked with logos of aid groups including the UN's World Food Program and UNICEF, as well as others labeled as belonging to the nonprofit World Central Kitchen and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There are also non-food items such as toilet paper, blankets, and charcoal. Speaking to reporters at the site, Israeli military spokesman Brigadier General Effi Defrin and Israel offered to secure UN aid convoys, but suggested the UN wasn't delivering the aid for political reasons. The UN said it can't accept Israeli offers to secure aid convoys because of its principle of neutrality in armed conflicts. Instead, it has asked Israel to clear safe routes. The UN Humanitarian Office says it hasn't been able to deliver aid because of unsafe conditions for staff and civilians and constraints imposed by Israeli authorities that have hampered their ability to operate. It cited long wait times for clearance, last-minute route changes, and denial of movement. The World Food Program said Sunday that it welcomed Israel's commitment to humanitarian pauses and corridors and hoped new measures would improve conditions on the ground. The UN said thousands of children are being treated for malnutrition, while its medical partners have reported that more than a dozen children have starved to death this month alone. Food shortages are widespread, affecting all parts of the strip and all classes of people, leaving children, women, the elderly, and those with injuries especially vulnerable. In a sign of how desperate the situation has become, Israel's Air Force resumed airdrops of aid overnight, parachuting 7 loads, including flour, sugar, and canned food, the military said. More packages were dropped in the hours since to both northern and southern Gaza in coordination with the United Arab Emirates and Jordan, the military said. Airdrops are typically a method of last resort as they are costly and can only deliver small volumes, and falling pallets can be dangerous or even deadly, as they were when used during an earlier hunger crisis in Gaza in the spring of 2024. Since a ceasefire collapsed in March, Israel's military has taken control of about 70% of the Gaza Strip. Israeli officials say and issued widespread evacuation orders that have pushed much of the population into a small area along the coast. The tactical pause announced Sunday will begin in areas where the armed forces aren't currently operating, the military said, namely the major population centers of Al-Masawi, Deir al-Balah, and Gaza City. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand at our website at sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio as we continue on with the article. Israel began a total blockade of the Gaza Strip in early March, banning the entry of all aid and commercial goods to put pressure on Hamas as talks to release more hostages held by the group faltered. Israel says Hamas steals aid and uses it to fund its war effort, which the group denies. Humanitarian groups say they have seen no evidence of systemic diversions of aid. Supplies stockpiled during the ceasefire earlier this year had largely run out by May when Israel unveiled a new U.S.-backed aid distribution system meant to circumvent the one led by the UN. Since its launch later that month, the new system, called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, has been beset by problems. The GHF's four distribution sites have frequently been overrun by massive crowds of hungry Palestinians, causing chaotic scenes that have turned deadly. Israeli soldiers have shot at crowds they have said have come too close to military positions near the sites. Palestinian health authorities say more than 1,000 people have been killed while trying to get aid from GHF and other aid groups, including UN agencies. Israel's military said that the death toll is overstated. The UN and other aid groups say desperation caused by scarcity is leading many Palestinians to risk their lives in an effort to get food for their families. There are currently just two border crossings through which aid can enter Gaza, which has a population of more than 2 million people. The UN says the entire population of Gaza is reliant on humanitarian assistance. Housing. With individual home buyers on the sidelines, investors swoop into the market. High interest rates and prices aren't deterring firms from snapping up single-family properties. By Rebecca Picciotto. Individual home buyers are largely locked out of the housing market as home prices continue to climb and interest rates remain stuck. But investors are buying and dominating the market. So far in 2025, investors who buy homes to flip or rent out have made up about 30% of purchases of both existing and newly built single-family homes, the highest share on record, according to property analytics from Cotality, which started tracking the sales about 14 years ago. There is also a change in the makeup of single-family residential investors who have become a powerful force in the U.S. housing market. This buying group was once flooded with private equity firms such as Blackstone and Starwood Capital Group. But in the first half of this year, small investors make up about 25% of these home purchases, while large investors accounted for about 5% on average, according to Cotality's data. This shift happened mostly because large investors and traditional home buyers have slowed down while small investors are holding steady. Small investors who own fewer than 100 homes are securing more discounts and financial incentives from sellers eager to close deals quickly as inventory piles up and traditional home buyers sit on the sidelines waiting for stubbornly high prices to fall. It's not just the Blackstones of the world anymore, said Rajan Bhatt, president of Strand Capital, which has purchased about 100 homes in markets including Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Indianapolis. Home investors, of course, are also sensitive to the high prices and interest rates that have made this year's selling season a dud. Some large buyers that pioneered the real estate investment business after the global financial crisis are slowing down their acquisitions as costs surge. Local and federal regulators also have been cracking down on investors buying up homes, which they claim makes it harder for regular buyers to compete and drives up prices even further. Big investors, Invitation Homes, Progress Residential, and Amherst are all disposing of more homes than they are buying up so far this quarter, according to data from real estate analytics firms Parcel Labs. We're acquiring at a fraction of what we were several years ago, partly because of high interest rates, said Chris Avalone, chief financial officer of Amherst, which owns about 46,000 homes. So why are smaller investors more active? For starters, even with prices and interest rates high, they still see a solid business in buying, fixing up, and renting out single-family homes. Strand Capital, the small real estate private equity firm, targets single-family homes within the $250,000 price range. It will make about a $75,000 down payment and invest about up to $15,000 in light renovations. It will then charge $2,000 to $2,200 a month in rent, with the expectation that the home price will appreciate 5% each year. After 3 years, Strand will try to sell the home at a profit. Smaller firms say they can take more risk than big institutions because they don't have to report to pension funds or other outside stakeholders. They are also benefiting because they are competing against fewer traditional home buyers who have checked out of the market because of higher prices. They might offer all-cash bids, avoiding high interest rates, and can close in a matter of weeks rather than months. Home builders often cut deals with the large single-family residential companies such as Invitation Homes. Until recently, small investors had to fight harder for those same discounts. That changed this year because builders are confronting a glut of supply in certain markets such as Texas and Florida. They are now rushing to clear their inventory and free up cash on their balance sheets. Builders including Lennar and D.R. Horton are offering more discounts and other incentives to help work off inventory. In July, 38% of builders reported lowering prices on their deals, the most since 2022, according to National Association of Home Builders. Those deals are bringing new investors to the market. Casey Sherman, a senior director at JLL's Capital Markets branch in Charlotte, North Carolina, said he has helped about a dozen clients break into the single-family home investment sector over the past year and a half. Some of these new clients are small funds representing wealthy individuals who had previously invested in industrial or office real estate. Others are multifamily investors looking to expand. Bruce McNeilage, who first started investing in single-family properties 2 decades ago, is eyeing these new players as they enter the arena. He focuses on southeastern markets including Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina, growing hotspots for single-family investment. New companies are getting into the market, it seems like every week, says McNeilage. Some are dipping their toes in the water, some are starting to put the whole foot in. China. C.K. Hutchinson to include Chinese investor in Panama port deal. C.K. Hutchinson didn't identify the Chinese company, by Pierre Venkat. C.K. Hutchinson Holdings is in talks with BlackRock-led consortium to include a strategic investor from China to push ahead with its plans to sell ports on either side of the Panama Canal. Although the exclusive negotiations period with the consortium has expired, C.K. Hutchinson said Monday that it was in talks with them to invite a strategic investor from mainland China. C.K. Hutchinson didn't identify the Chinese company. Earlier this month, the Wall Street Journal reported that China was pushing for state-owned Costco to be an equal partner and shareholder of the ports with BlackRock and Mediterranean Shipping Company, a container ship operator. Changes to the membership of the consortium and the structure of the transaction will be needed for the transaction to be capable of being approved by all relevant authorities, C.K. Hutchinson said. In early March, a BlackRock-led consortium had agreed to buy majority stakes in ports on either end of the Panama Canal. This would put U.S. firms in control of two ports which President Trump has identified as a security concern due to their Chinese connections. The deal under negotiation with C.K. Hutchinson is worth $22.8 billion and includes dozens of other ports around the world, excluding those in China. The Wall Street Journal reported in March that Chinese leader Xi Jinping was angered by the deal, and Beijing was reviewing what tools it might have to hinder it. In the same month, China's antitrust regulator said that it would review the agreement to ensure fair competition and protect public interest. C.K. Hutchison said Monday that it intends to allow sufficient time for discussions to achieve new arrangements. The company has stated on several occasions that it will not proceed with any transactions that does not have the approval of all relevant authorities, it said. Careers. CEOs trumpet smaller workforces as a sign of corporate health. Bosses aren't just unapologetic about staff cuts. Many are touting shrinking headcounts as accomplishments in the AI era, by Chip Cutter. Big companies are getting smaller and their CEOs want everyone to know it. The careful coded corporate language executives once used in describing staff cuts is giving way to blunt boasts about ever-shrinking workforces. Gone are the days when trimming headcounts signaled retrenchment or trouble. Bosses are showing off to Wall Street that they are embracing artificial intelligence and serious about becoming lean. After all, it is no easy feat to cut headcount for 20 consecutive quarters, an accomplishment Wells Fargo's chief executive officer touted this month. The bank is using attrition, as our friend Charlie Scharf said on the bank's quarterly earnings call, as he told investors that its headcount had fallen every quarter over the past 5 years by a total of 23% over the period. Loomis, the Swedish cash handling company, said it is managing to grow while reducing the number of employees, while Union Pacific, the rail operator, said its labor productivity had reached a record quarterly high as its staff size shrank by 3%. Last week, Verizon's CEO told investors that the company had been very, very good on headcount. Translation, it's going down all the time, Verizon's Hans Vesterberg said. The shift reflects a cooling labor market in which bosses are gaining an ever stronger upper hand and a new mindset on how best run a company. Pointing to startups that command millions in revenue with only a handful of employees, many executives see large workforces as an impediment, not an asset, according to management specialists. Some are taking their cues from companies such as Amazon.com, which recently told staff that AI would lead to a smaller workforce. Now there is almost a moral neutrality to headcount reductions, said Zach Mukia, head of capital markets and strategic advisory at the communications firm Sloan & Company. Being honest about cost and headcount isn't just allowed, it's rewarded by investors, Mukia said. Companies are used to discussing cuts, even human ones, in dollars and cents terms with investors. What is different is how more corporate bosses are recasting the headcount reductions as accomplishments that position their businesses for change, he said. It's a powerful kind of reframing device, Mukia said. Leaving roles unfilled. Large-scale layoffs aren't the main way companies are slimming down. More are slowing hiring, combining jobs, or keeping positions unfilled when staffers leave. The end result remains a smaller workforce. Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan reminded investors this month that the company's headcount had fallen significantly under his tenure. He became chief executive in 2010, and the bank had steadily rolled out more technology throughout its functions. Over the last 15 years or so, we went from 300,000 people to 212,000 people, Moynihan said, adding, we just got to keep working that down. Bank of America has slimmed down by selling some businesses, digitizing processes, and holding off on replacing some people when they quit over the years. AI will now allow the bank to change how it operates, Moynihan said. Employees in the company's wealth management division are using AI to search and summarize information for clients, while 17,000 programmers within the company are now using AI coding technology. One chat-based AI product is helping 750 employees reconcile trades. In the process, Moynihan said, the bank expects the technology will allow it to hire fewer full-time staff in that area or deploy headcount elsewhere. Overall, Bank of America's staff size has fallen by 1,500 people since the beginning of the year, excluding summer interns. The company plans to bring on 2,000 early career employees later this year. When managing costs, it always starts with us with headcount discipline, Alistair Borthwick, Bank of America's chief financial officer told investors this month. In industries where AI is taking on white-collar corporate functions, there is often little unionization, and employees might feel powerless to push back, said Molly Kinder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who is studying AI's effects on workers. She has been struck by how little public criticism companies have received when executives telegraph AI-related staffing reductions. I'm worried it's happening in plain sight with no blowback, no pushback, and it's going to become the norm, she said. I don't think that's good news for the American worker. Some employers seem almost to take pride in announcing efforts to increase revenue or profits while cutting staff or keeping headcount flat. Something feels remarkably different about this movement, she said. Very happy with that. Fast-rising companies are at the forefront of figuring out how to do more with less. Gary Tan, chief executive of Y Combinator, the Silicon Valley startup accelerator, said this spring that the biggest change he sees in the startup ecosystem now is how effective companies can be with hardly any employees using AI to grow. They can go from really $0 to $10 million a year in revenue, sometimes in the course of less than 12 months, and they can do it with less than 10 people, Tan said on a podcast. It's really sort of astonishing. Managers might face the heaviest toll. Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan said Thursday that the company planned to lay off 15% of its staff and cut layers of middle management to help reverse its fortunes after falling behind such rivals as Nvidia. We need to right-size and scale back the company, Tan said. Some leaders acknowledge the human cost of such layoffs. Microsoft announced this month plans to cut another 9,000 workers, bringing its job cuts to 15,000 in the past 2 months. In a memo to staff on Thursday, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella said the layoffs had weighed on him as the company reorients its business to AI. This is the enigma of success in an industry that has no franchise value, Nadella wrote. Progress isn't linear. It's dynamic, sometimes dissonant, and always demanding. Some reductions might have little to do with adoption of the technology and more with executives' desires to please investors. Efforts to reduce headcount or restrain hiring show that an executive has a willingness to make tough calls, Sloan's Mukaya said. Companies such as Verizon are letting investors know they are pleased too. The company's headcount is down roughly 4% from a year earlier, the telecommunications giant told investors last week. We have been very efficient on managing our resources, Vestberg, the CEO, said. So very happy with that. Trade. Trump and EU reach tariff deal avoiding trade war. Pact imposes baseline tariff of 15% on the U.S.'s biggest trade partner. By Kim Mackerel and Natalie Andrews. President Trump said he reached a trade agreement on Sunday with the European Union, avoiding a damaging trade war with the U.S.'s largest trading partner and marking his biggest deal so far in his attempt to remake the global trading system through higher tariffs for U.S. trading partners. Trump said the U.S. would see a baseline tariff of 15% for European goods, including automobiles. He said the EU has agreed as part of the deal to buy $750 billion of energy products from the U.S. and invest an additional $600 billion in the U.S. I think it's going to be great for both parties, Trump said, following face-to-face talks Sunday with European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen in Trump's golf resort in Turnberry, Scotland. The European deal is the most consequential agreement Trump has so far announced. The EU is America's biggest regional trading partner when the bloc's 27 member states, which share a common trade policy, are considered together its top source of foreign investment. The two sides exchange more than $5 billion worth of goods and services every day. Today's deal creates certainty in uncertain times, von der Leyen said. She said the 15% level would apply for the vast majority of EU exports, including cars, semiconductors, and pharmaceuticals. The 15% level is the best we could get, she said. The terms disclosed on Sunday suggest that 15% is likely a new minimum tariff level for most American trading partners. Economists and trade analysts say tariffs at that level will have an effect on companies' decisions and are expected to contribute to higher prices for Americans, but won't stop global trade flows. They are not the level where the global economy burns down, said Dmitry Grozbinski, senior trade advisor at Aurora Macro Strategies. The European deal comes after a flurry of recent trade announcements. Trump said this past week that he had reached a deal with Japan, another top U.S. trading partner, which puts baseline tariffs at 15%. Separate agreements set Vietnam's baseline tariff level at 20% and established a 19% rate for the Philippines and Indonesia, Trump has said. The deal should ease anxieties that Trump's drive could lead to a broader trade war and provide some clarity for business. Grozbinski said a lot of disruption for businesses had been because of the unpredictability of the Trump administration's trade policies. While most don't want tariffs to rise at all, they would prefer a steady 15% tariff compared with a lower rate that is less predictable. Neither side published the text of their agreement on Sunday. Although both presidents said that the EU's baseline tariff would be 15%, they appeared to have different interpretations of some of the details. Trump indicated in comments to the press that his global steel and aluminum tariffs, which are currently at 50%, would remain unchanged. Von der Leyen said the two had agreed to a quota system that would keep tariffs lower for some EU metal exports to the U.S. Trump also said the EU had agreed to open up their countries to trade at zero tariff. Von der Leyen said the two had agreed to zero tariffs for certain strategic products, including aircrafts and their parts, certain chemicals, semiconductor equipment, and certain agricultural products, among others, and said the two sides would work to add more products to that list. She said the EU would give U.S. companies better access to the bloc's market. The deal provides a framework to further lower tariffs on more products, addresses non-tariff barriers, and cooperate on economic security, von der Leyen said. We have the opening up of all the European countries, which I think I could say were essentially closed, Trump said. Details on Trump's other trade deals have also been scant. The administration has released no documentation for deals it claims to have reached with the Philippines or Japan, and details released of the Indonesian deal last week remain incomplete. The UK's framework released in May also left some big items unresolved, like steel tariff levels. Trump had earlier put a 10% baseline tariff on most EU goods that are exported to the U.S., as well as a 25% tariff on its auto industry and a 50% tariff for steel and aluminum. But he had threatened to impose 30% tariffs on the bloc if a deal wasn't reached by August 1, a level that European officials had suggested could effectively shut down some trade flows. The UK has the lowest tariff Trump has so far agreed to as a part of the deal. At 10%. Trump also expected to iron out final details of the UK agreement in meetings with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on Monday. Analysts said financial markets would welcome the deal. The EU in recent days had finalized plans for retaliatory tariffs that could have been used to hit more than $100 billion in U.S. exports if trade talks broke down. Some of the biggest outstanding talks are with Mexico, Canada, and China, the second largest economy in the world. U.S. and Chinese officials are set to meet in Stockholm on Monday and Tuesday, where the two sides are expected to discuss extending their trade truce beyond its current August 12th expiration date. Both sides have pulled back on the highest tariffs they had applied to each other's goods earlier this year, although U.S. levies on China remain higher than they were before Trump took office. An EU deal with 15% baseline tariffs is likely to be welcomed by financial markets because it would avert the risk of an escalating trade fight, Capital economist Andrew Kenneman said recently. Tariffs at that level would lower the EU's gross domestic product by about 0.3%, he said, with Germany being hit harder while France and Spain would be less affected. Those tariffs would damp German auto exports, but are unlikely to be a knockout blow to the sector, Kenneman said. European officials expect that the 15% baseline tariff will keep average levies at a similar level to what they are currently, because they wouldn't be cumulative with duties that existed before Trump's return to office earlier this year. The EU has said it is already facing an effective average tariff rate that is close to 15%, because Trump's 10% baseline tariff was stacked on top of the U.S.'s pre-existing tariffs. European officials were prepared for a difficult negotiating session on Sunday. The EU's Trade Commissioner, Markos Sefcovic, sought advice from Japanese officials on Saturday to get a better sense of what to expect, a person familiar with the matter said. He learned that those discussions, which lasted more than an hour, went beyond surface-level talks and delved into the details of the agreement. The Europeans hunkered down in a hotel in Glasgow on Sunday to discuss what kind of messaging would be most effective during the meeting with Trump, a person familiar with their preparations said. Von der Leyen brought several of her top trade and political officials into the meeting with her, including Sefcovic. Trump was accompanied in Scotland by Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer, among others. When asked what his next focus would be on trade deals, Trump turned the focus back to the European deal. "This is the biggest of them all," he said. U.S. At least 11 people injured in Michigan Walmart attack. Stabbing suspect in custody, no motive known, police say. By Ginger Adams Otis. At least 11 people were injured Saturday in a Traverse City, Michigan Walmart store after a suspect stabbed them, according to authorities. A 42-year-old male suspect was in custody, Traverse City officials said. The suspect is believed to have acted alone and was apprehended within minutes, according to the Grand Traverse County Sheriff's Office. The suspect entered the Walmart store just after 4 p.m. Saturday, and the violence broke out roughly 30 minutes later, according to Grand Traverse County Sheriff Mike Shea. Law enforcement responded to the first 911 call within 3 minutes and found the suspect being held in the parking lot by citizens who prevented him from leaving. One of the citizens was armed with a pistol, the sheriff said. "I commend them. It's not very often we have citizens willing to step up and take action," Shea said at a Sunday press conference. "What they did was amazing." The suspect used a 3.5-inch folding knife in the attack, the sheriff said. The victims included men and women whose ages range from 29 to 84 years old, and one of them was a Walmart store employee. Authorities described the incident as a random act of violence and said the suspect has a history of assaultative incidents. The 11 victims of the attack were in fair or serious condition Sunday, according to Munson Healthcare, one of Northern Michigan's largest healthcare systems. A Walmart spokesperson said the Traverse City store will continue working with law enforcement for the duration of the investigation. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.